From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
It was just about 2 years of constant rejection. Also trying to go after certain casting that resulted mainly in constant rejection. And it was just sort of one thing after another where the project seemed to kind of die more and more each day that passed.
Sure, director Damien Chazelle's La La Land is a hit now with 14 Oscar nominations. But in the beginning, his dream of making an original musical seemed like it might just be too crazy of a gamble. Chazelle and his longtime friend and collaborator, composer Justin Hurwitz, tell us how they fought through setbacks to make one of the year's most formidable awards contenders. But first on the News Banter, the studio with this year's most impressive Oscar performance is... Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. This is our first conversation since the Oscar nominations came out. A really good go-round for Lionsgate, which has a bunch of films in competition in a bunch of different ways.
Right. If you're looking at the studio scorecard, which everyone around Hollywood tends to do this time of year, you've got to look at Lionsgate as the big winner. Not only are they the distributor of La La Land, which is the record nominations, 14, they have Hacksaw Ridge, the Mel Gibson movie, which got a ton of nominations as well, and a surprise nomination for Mel Gibson as Best Director. They also are the distributor for CBS Films' Hell or High Water, which got a Best Picture nomination. And then they also own a portion of Roadside Attractions, which is the theatrical distributor for Amazon for Manchester by the Sea. So if you look at the behind-the-scenes machinations here, Lionsgate has a piece of 4 Best Picture nominations. That's kind of nuts.
And a bunch of other significant nominations, obviously. Casey Affleck, Manchester by the Sea, Jeff Bridges, Best Supporting Actor, Hell or High Water. So, yes, and Lucas Hedges and Manchester by the Sea, just a bunch. So that's good. And I'll mention one other kind of, counterintuitive thing, which is that Paramount Pictures, which has been struggling so much, has 2 in contention. More than Fox Searchlight, which doesn't have any and normally is in this game. Fox is in there with Hidden Figures, but Paramount Pictures has Arrival and Fences. So you can be kind of off the radar as a studio and still manage to get yourself into that Oscar game.
And if you look at the major studios, I mean, it's pretty interesting. 4 of the 6 major studios don't have any Best Picture nomination. Disney, Warner Brothers, which is usually a big player in the Oscar race, Universal doesn't have one this year, and Sony, which has been so troubled this year, doesn't have a Best Picture nomination. They have nominations elsewhere, and a lot of them, but in that key Best Picture race of the 9 nominees, 4 studios don't have one.
Yeah, which tells you what kind of movies the studios are pursuing these days. Now, we mentioned Manchester by the Sea, and you just got back from very cold year at Sundance.
Cold weather, but a hot deal market.
Yeah, hot deal market. And Manchester by the Sea is like a poster child for that. It was picked up by Amazon last year, and now Amazon has won the race to get a Best Picture nomination, which is it was trying to do before Netflix did, and Netflix was trying to get there first and did not. And that is a competition these guys take seriously. Netflix, therefore, has come into Sundance, as has Amazon, with their wallets wide open, once again, trying to outdo each other.
Right. I mean, Manchester by the Sea is the modern Sundance success story in that it was a sale to Amazon last year for $10 million. They guaranteed a theatrical run. It's made about $40 million in theaters, and Amazon put their money behind an Oscar campaign, and it's got a Best Picture nomination, and Casey Affleck is probably going to win Best Actor. So this is what everyone goes to Sundance this year trying for. And Amazon paid $12 million this year for a comedy called The Big Sick, by Michael Showalter, probably not a Best Picture play, but the competition has really risen among these digital streamers between Netflix and Amazon. So everyone is having to pay more for movies at Sundance. You're seeing $5, $7, $8, $10 million price tags. Fox Searchlight paid $10 million for this suburban rapper comedy called Patty Cakes. And even these companies like Sony Pictures Classics, which used to just swoop in and pick up movies for $1 million here, $2 million there, they're shelling out $5 million for movies now because if they don't, all the movies are going to go to Netflix or Amazon.
So, Matt, you mentioned that Mel Gibson has had this comeback. And, we see this in Hollywood. You've written about it. People who are part of the establishment get forgiven for a lot of stuff that might seem that especially Hollywood wouldn't forgive. and others don't. However, Roman Polanski was selected to be president of France's César Awards, and feminists in the country started to protest, and he quickly resigned. So while Roman Polanski has been recognized by the Academy here and gotten a standing ovation, it seems that in France, his decision to leave the country after raping a 13-year-old at the time, notwithstanding the fact that this 13-year-old is now an adult who has said she forgives him, that has not smoothed things over in France.
No, and it just goes to show that, you know, the line between forgiveness and non-forgiveness is very sketchy, and some people are, some people aren't. It's hard to predict how this happens.
The artist versus the art. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter.
City of stars, are you shining just for me? City of stars, there's so much that I can't see.
That's Oscar nominee Ryan Gosling singing City of Stars, one of two songs, also in Oscar contention, from Best Picture nominee La La Land. Those are among 14 nominations for La La Land, a total that shares the record with only two other films, 1950's All About Eve and 1997's Titanic. La La Land tells the story of a romance between aspiring actress Mia, played by Emma Stone, and Ryan Gosling's Sebastian, a jazz musician who dreams of running his own nightclub. Early in the film, the two keep running into each other, and you know where that's going.
I got a call back.
What? Come on! For what?
For a TV show. The one that I was telling you about earlier.
The Dangerous Minds meets the OC?
Yeah.
Congratulations, that's
really
incredible.
Exciting. I feel like I said negative stuff about it before.
What?
It's like Rebel Without a Cause, sort of.
I got the bullets.
Yes.
You've never seen it.
I've never seen it.
Oh my. You know it's playing at the Rialto.
Really?
Yes. You should, I can take you.
Okay.
You know, for research.
For research?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
La La Land was written and directed by 32-year-old Damien Chazelle, who was on the business 2 years ago when his drama Whiplash was contending for Oscar. La La Land has brought him nominations for Best Director and Best Original Screenplay. Should he prevail in the directing category, he'd be the youngest winner ever. The music of La La Land comes from composer Justin Hurwitz, also 32. Hurwitz majored in music at Harvard, which is where he and Chazelle met. When we sat down with them, Hurwitz said at first, Chazelle was more interested in musicals than he was.
I wouldn't say I was into musicals before college. I grew up on certain musicals, you know, Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and The Wizard of Oz and things like that. But
not the classics.
Yeah, and I certainly didn't know the MGM musicals or the French new wave musicals that Damien turned me on to in college. I think it was when we were roommates that we started to bond over those movies, and Damien was introducing me to a lot of those movies, and they became my favorite movies. And then we started talking about movies that we would want to make, and naturally we sort of gravitated towards musicals.
So you guys started working on Guy and Madeline on a park bench, mm-hmm. and that was a senior project, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah.
So you did this for a black and white movie. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of like proto La La Land.
It was the same philosophy as La La Land in the sense that it was an attempt to take what we loved from the MGM musicals and some of the French New Wave musicals, but smash it all with real life, you know, put it in a modern city, shoot it on the streets, make a story about ordinary people today trying to make ends meet. So it was a little bit of that kind of fantasy meets reality sort of thing that I think led to La La Land, but it was our first crack at that kind of idea. It was a slightly different angle on it, though. It was more kind of more like fully documentary style, you know, and it was all 16mm handheld black and white on the streets of Boston with mainly non-actors.
So you do that, and then you go from there and you think, let's make this into the bigger version of it.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there was an executive at Focus at the time, Matthew Plouffe, who probably the only person in Hollywood to watch Guy Madeline. And he gave me a call and he was into it. And he just kind of, you know, he kind of asked me, you know, would you be interested in
doing another musical at some point. And I had been thinking of other musical ideas, and I said yes. And so that began a process of a few years of kind of batting ideas back and forth. And eventually, Justin and I started working on the script and music for La La Land when Matt Pluff paired us up with two producers in LA, Fred Berger and Jordan Horowitz. And it was initially a Focus Features kind of low-budget project. That's where our home initially was.
So we did a whole show about Whiplash and how you made the short. Mm-hmm. And the short, I think, won an award at Sundance and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. Go back and listen to the podcast from last time we talked to Damien and you will hear the whole story. It's a good story. And of course, Whiplash became Whiplash. But meanwhile, Lionsgate is, how's that working, the timing?
Well, no, so we were developing La La Land at Focus. I wrote Whiplash on the side because La La Land wasn't really going anywhere and Whiplash kind of seemed an easier to put together project. And then literally, you know, as at that point I'd been expecting, La La Land got put into turnaround by Focus. And it was one of those, you know, those kind of crazy Hollywood days where the same day, I remember very vividly in the morning, I get the call that we're in turnaround at Focus. So we're no longer making the movie there. And later that day, I get a call from, or an email from these producers, Jason Blum and Cooper Samuelson and Jason Reitman, the director, and his producer, Helen Estabrook. And they want to team up and produce this script, Whiplash. And during that whole time, while I was off, Justin and I were off doing Whiplash, Fred and Jordan, the producers, were basically kind of pounding the pavement for La La Land, which was an orphaned project at that point. So there was no Lionsgate. There was nothing, really. It was just about 2 years of constant rejection and also trying to go after certain casting things that resulted mainly in constant rejection. And it was just sort of one thing after another where the project seemed to kind of die more and more each day that passed. But the light at the end of the tunnel, the hope, that what became the kind of outsized hope was that once it seemed like Whiplash was actually going to get made as a feature, was that, okay, maybe this can be the kind of calling card. Maybe this, if this turns out half decent, this can finally convince people that we can make this musical. So I think Fred and Jordan, what they did that was really smart was they stopped all the meetings once Whiplash was getting produced. They basically halted everything. They said, we're not going to do anything until Whiplash is done. And then they kind of lined up these prospective, you know, interested suitors on the eve of Sundance, crossing their fingers that like Whiplash would
not land with a thud.
It was our last card to play, basically. We had nothing left. And Whiplash premiered at Sundance. They immediately set up these meetings. I met with Lionsgate at Sundance, came back to LA. Justin and I and our producers, we met with a few other financiers here in LA. Most people still passed on the project, I should note. But we were able to line up a few of these key meetings. And Lionsgate was just the most passionate of the bunch. And we locked down that financing about 3 months after Sundance.
I mean, honestly, I'm surprised there was more than one studio.
There was two. let's be honest.
It was 100% more than I thought.
Yes.
Meanwhile, I read with La La Land that you were sending stuff to Damien, like working on your own and sending him stuff, much of which he apparently did not like.
That's the process for any movie we do.
It's a lot of sending back and forth.
It's piano demos flying around by email all day long for months, however long it takes.
I'm not suggesting that it was anything unusual, just that it's a lot of throwing spaghetti at the wall.
I think it is unusual in terms of how early we start and how long we spend just finding the material before it actually comes to scoring to the picture. All three movies we've done, I mean, those are unique in the sense that being two of those being musicals and one of them being a music-driven movie, it actually needed pre-recorded music before the movie could shoot. But I think any movie we do that just needs a score, that just needs a dramatic underscore, whereas normally you start that process in post-production. Okay, now there's a cut. Now let's start scoring it. I think Damien and I are going to try to start before the movie even shoots because the thematic material is so important to us and we love melodic scores and we love scores that have real sort of hummable themes, that kind of thematic material in a score. So that can take a very, very long time to find at least, the best version of it. So it's me sitting at the piano trying melody after melody, theme after theme, you know, waiting till I have what I think is a really good idea, sending it to Damien. Damien says, no, not quite right. And then I go back to the drawing board and just keep doing it and doing it. And so I did a little over 1,900 piano demos on La La Land.
Ooh.
Just at the beginning, just finding the material. And that doesn't mean 1,900 different melodies because we'd find one and then Damien would say, oh, that's really promising. And then I'd go down that road for a while. You know, theme 24 and I'd go 24A, 24B, 24C and I'd explore it. And then we'd say, you know what, think we can do better and I would move on. So it just takes a very long time to find melodies sometimes. And I also don't want to be boxed in. I don't want to be in post-production and there's a cut and I have like 6 weeks, 8 weeks before the score date and I have to, because that point, you know, it's a lot of work just to score to the picture, just to create those cues that work with the picture and that work, you know, emotionally and rhythmically with what's going on screen. So by that point, I want to know what the melodies are, what the themes are. So we need to do that process earlier.
So when you were working on Whiplash, had you done any La La Land composition musically?
Yeah, a lot of it, because we had developed La La Land before we started working on Whiplash. So
I mean,
pretty early on we had, I remember, you know, before our time at Focus ended, we did have a full album of demos and a full script, you know, so we had this kind of full package, so to speak. Now,
a lot of those got thrown out. Some really key material, like the main theme of the movie that we call Mia and Sebastian's theme, that was my first task. Like as soon as Damien started writing the treatment, he said, compose that theme, find what that theme is. So that was the first thing I composed in 2011. And that was in
wow,
that original,
that's a long ago.
That was in that original package of demos. And that never changed. Once we found that, it took a long time to find it. But once we found that theme, that never changed. Most of the songs in that original music package got thrown out. A couple of them
reappropriated.
Or reappropriated. And then, of course, you know, once we met our lyricists, Benj Pask and Justin Paul in 2014, then what we were calling songs, they were instrumental at the time, then they really became songs because Benj and Justin wrote all the words to those melodies, and then we had proper songs.
So when you asked Justin to come up with this early theme, mm-hmm. what was the point for you? Like, you couldn't wait and say, let's come up with the theme after I do this, that, and the other thing. I want the theme right now.
Yeah, because it was as important as the story or as the characters. It was as important as any element on the page of the script. You know, you just had to kind of figure out what that glue was going to be, this theme that would be reprised throughout the movie that would kind of come to signify the characters' love for each other. And, you know, I agree with Justin about there's a tradition of theme-based scores that it's not that it's so much a lost tradition. It's just that I do think there's less reliance on melody now in score. And so you think of kind of certain melodic themes that just immediately evoke not just a movie, but an entire world that the movie evokes. All you have to hear is a few notes of Nino Rota's theme for The Godfather or Constantin's theme for The 400 Blows or, you know, Max Steiner's theme for Gone with the Wind. And it just kind of, you're immediately there. There's a certain kind of loadedness that music has. It's like the Madeleine and that Proust writes about. It's just like this immediate emotional
thing.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. so I knew it would also help me write. To be honest, you know, it's the best way to nail down what the tone of the movie is going to be, figure out what the basic spine of the melody that's going to hang it together is going to be, and then write based on that while Justin is composing based on that. I mean, all the songs are kind of written in answer to that theme as well. You know, we had to start with that, and then everything became a song suite kind of composed as around that.
So you had like an outline of script before you had the
theme?
I at
least had a treatment. I forget the exact order. I might have started writing actual scenes, but it was very early in the writing process. I did have a story that Justin was working off of, so he knew what this theme had to accomplish narratively in a broad strokes kind of way, but it was purposefully very, very early in the process.
And in the treatment and then the script, it even said in what Damien was writing where the theme would be used. You know, he'd say, we start on this overture that is built from this theme. We have the planetarium sequence that is built from this theme, comes back in the fantasy sequence at the end, a couple of other places. So I knew where in the movie it was going to be used. And then, like Damien said, that kind of informed the songs. The songs don't actually use that theme or that melody, but they definitely, once we locked down that theme, then we kind of knew this is the sound of the movie, this is the harmonic palette of the movie. I also orchestrated it because I was, you know, we were turning it into an overture at the time. So then I kind of knew this is the orchestral language of the movie too. And we started sort of figuring out what the sound and flavor and color of the music would be.
Coming up after a short break, La La Land director Damien Chazelle and composer Justin Hurwitz tell us why they didn't try to cast a modern-day version of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, even though they were making a musical. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer-director Damien Chazelle and composer Justin Hurwitz about their movie musical, La La Land, the dominant contender in this year's awards race. In the film, we see Emma Stone as struggling actress Mia, who finally lands the big audition. A tentative song turns into a bold ballad.
And here's to the fools who dream crazy.
Critics fell for La La Land from the moment it premiered at the Venice Film Festival last August. Audiences have been charmed, too. The film will gross more than $100 million, and with awards attention, probably a lot more. None of that was foreseeable when Chazelle and Hurwitz set out to make La La Land. Then it was just a risky idea from a new filmmaker. It took years to find financing for it, and by the time Chazelle and Hurwitz finally got a green light, they'd had plenty of time to think about it.
So, you know, it was a little bit of benefit of actually the movie having lots of stops and starts. Like Justin and the lyricists would actually wind up working on the music longer than we'd even planned because the start date would keep getting pushed. And then our choreographer, Mandy Moore, came on board initially for a certain start date. And that start date got axed, but she stuck around and kept working and refining and building and revising. And that kind of happened with a lot of the key people, David Wasko and Sandy Wasko, our production designers. So it was actually, again, kind of a little bit of a blessing in disguise, you know, the bumps along the road.
Although I'm sure at the time they felt like not a blessing.
Well, they always feel like the movie's falling apart, yeah, and that it's never going to come back together again.
You lost your two leads, Miles Teller, and there was a little bit of weirdness that I read about that. I heard he was offered a great deal of money, $4 million, and then it seemed to be a miscommunication about whether he wanted to do the movie.
Yeah, that's not, all of that is, I've read something that's not entirely true, but Miles and I are on good terms, and I remain a giant fan of his, hope to work with him down the line.
And then Emma, I heard Emma Watson wanted to shoot in London, which is crazy because it's La La Land.
It's so funny when I hear these stories that, I can see where the London thing, okay, well.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot, just what I heard.
No, it's funny hearing, the way some of these things kind of wind up. I'd say what really kind of happened at the end of the day was, through no fault of, intentional fault of anyone, a few of these casting iterations fell through, either through scheduling would be a constant kind of battle, and budget and everything. You know, part of the challenge actually in finding cast for this movie was that it wasn't just a normal shoot commitment. You know, it wasn't just you come in and you shoot for the 2 or 3 months that we shoot and then you're more or less out. It was you come in 4 months before we start shooting and you're living with us during that time. Like, you are basically as busy as though you were shooting during that time. Then you shoot, and then of course we
super
might need you to do
commitment.
Post-dubbing and whatnot afterwards. So it's just a much more involved thing, and you had to be okay with that, and you had to be able to juggle that. And so I think that was part of the reason why it took so long to kind of cast the movie, but also part of the reason why it worked out with Ryan and Emma was that, for whatever reason, that's kind of how they work and how they wanted to work. And I remember my very first meetings with them, the first thing on both of their, heads independently was, how much time will we have to rehearse?
Well, I imagine somebody reading that script and just going, I'm sorry, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm not really a singer and dancer.
Yeah.
The piano with Ryan, too.
He learned to play the piano,
read. Yeah, he was doing piano lessons like 6 days a week. And he...
For four months.
Did he have any musical background?
He did, yeah.
Very basic piano, but he really had to learn everything see him doing.
I mean, I will just pause and say, certain people, and they tend to be like closer to maybe 70 than 30, they say, well, they're not Fred or Sarah and Ginger Rogers. They were great. And I know it was a choice, but I don't know if it even would have been possible to do it, because does anybody who is a movie star have the level of skill? And would that work even if you wanted to make it
work? Yeah, I mean, there's obviously kind of a bunch of people right now who sort of crossed the line between Broadway and film. And there's a whole sort of pool of people that you could have done a different version of this movie with. It just wasn't the version that was interesting to me. The much more interesting thing to me was to try to kind of put people like us in the center of the musical. In other words, you see a number and you kind of know instinctively that these aren't people who have trained their whole lives to do this number, and they're not doing the movie kind of waiting for their number to start. You know, that this had to actually be almost a surprise for the audience that Ryan and Emma or a lot of the other people in the movie were bursting into song. It had to feel like, oh, normal people, I say normal people, kind
right.
of in quotes,
normal
you know,
people
but,
who are movie stars,
but like, sort of people who operate by the normal grammar of ordinary non-musical movies, who we do not associate with musicals, stage or screen, they burst into song. When the emotion calls for it, they become this thing. But they're clearly stepping outside their comfort zone. And so you get a certain kind of a nervousness and a vulnerability out of that I really love. It was part of why I also wanted to shoot it all in long takes and really kind of see there's just these things that happen between people and happen, especially with movie stars where you're not used to seeing them anything but larger than life. To see a movie star actually try something different can actually be an incredibly
humanizing thing, you know? It's all about
trying to... I'm in awe that they wanted to do it. I really admire that.
Yeah, so I needed people who were willing to take on that kind of exposure, willing to do the work to actually pull it off in any way, but maintain a certain kind of humanity to it and make sure that the numbers never stopped being about emotion. Like the biggest thing I was always drilling in their head was, it's all acting. It's not like you stop acting and you start dancing, or you stop acting and you start singing. You have to approach this as all acting. It's just variations of the same thing, but you're the same character and you have to act that way the entire movie.
Amazing. I mean, did they not say, I don't know that I can actually do this? Because I imagine myself crying.
There were definitely some nerves. I think Justin and I also probably had our moments of going, I don't know if I can do this. I think actually the one thing that probably got all of us through the movie was that no one really making the movie was sure we would do it. You know,
right.
That like all of us knew we were kind of stepping out on a ledge a little bit, but we had each other's backs and you get a kind of energy from that and a kind of exhilaration from it. I think it just inspires you to work harder, hopefully.
And the studio never went, could you just maybe not, I don't know, fill in the blank?
It's part of the reason why we signed up with Lionsgate was that they were actually willing to kind of back our vision. Through the course of trying to get financing, I heard lots of ideas for how to make the music less jazzy and how to, you know, have it be all...
Oh, they wanted to do like a rock.
Radio-ready pop music.
Yeah. What if he's not a jazz musician? What if he's a rock musician?
Right.
Yeah.
Like literally the hot song of that week in the top 40 was like, hey, what if the music is more like that?
Did
that
you just kind of go, okay, great, well, thanks. It's been great meeting you.
Yes. I mean, I actually listen to Top 40 when I'm in the car more than anything else. Like, that is actually what's on my radio. I love that stuff. But we didn't want it to sound like it was today's music. We didn't want to sound like it was old-fashioned. We didn't want to pin it, I assume. Yeah, or a knockoff of anything. We didn't want to pin it to now. We didn't want to pin it to 50 years ago. So having to sort of chase any reference too closely was always going to be a problem.
And now you're talking about this Neil Armstrong biopic. This would be... with Ryan Gosling.
Mm-hmm. Ironically, I met with Ryan. The first time I met with Ryan was to talk about Neil Armstrong. And he started talking about like Busby Berkeley. And suddenly I was like, oh my God, you love musicals as much as I do. And you know, him doing La La Land followed from that. But a long way of saying that I've been working on First Man for a few years now, working with Josh Singer, who wrote Spotlight. And I think of it as less of a biopic about Neil Armstrong and more a mission movie, more just a movie about what it actually took to land on the moon. Starts in 61, ends in 69, leading up to the moon landing and including the moon landing. So I don't know, I think in some ways, somewhat similarly to Whiplash or even La La Land, it's a movie about the pursuit of a goal and what that costs.
I'm excited to do something dark as a change of pace, you know?
Yeah, tonally it will be a little closer to Whiplash than La La Land, yeah.
If Neil Armstrong starts singing, I will be surprised.
Well...
never seen
and they're ever. they're still developing it, so you never know.
I'm not even going to make any assumptions because you already amazed me by getting to make La La Land.
We already did that kind of, you know, waltz in space in La La Land, so, you know.
Yeah.
That's true. The template is there.
It could be 4-4 in space, though.
Yeah, exactly.
You haven't done that yet.
No, we haven't done that
yet.
It
could be what in space?
4-4. Waltz is three. It's in three.
Okay,
done.
Sorry.
Three,
everything to Justin is about music and music.
Exposing
theory.
My musical knowledge once again, or lack thereof. Right. Okay. Damien Chazelle is the director, and Justin Hurwitz is the composer of La La Land. Thank you guys for coming in.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for having us.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance this week from Ray Guarna and Christopher Ho. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.